Welcome, everybody, to another Unusual Whales panel. This time, again, sponsored by our friends at Tama ETFs, who manage the American Reshoring ETF, ticker RSHO, amongst many other funds. You can learn more about them here in a moment. I'll be pinning a link to the top. But those of you who have attended our spaces before know that I like to keep the panels wide open to discussion. So as we go through our topics on tariffs and recent developments therein, panelists, please feel free to chime in where you seem fit. Just give a little breath of fresh air between speakers so we can avoid any overlap or feedback in the background. Now, as we will be discussing individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different, so you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully so you make sure it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing discussed in this space should be construed as actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or derivatives, to conduct your own research, or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. Now, with that spiel out of the way, let's dive into introductions for our panelists, starting off, of course, with Yuri Kojamirian, the CIO of today's sponsor, Tama ETFs. Yuri has over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios, co-managed the Magity Fund, raising several billion dollars in assets, and in previous panels, I always say it and I always will, Yuri's feedback has been crucial to driving these conversations. Welcome back, Yuri.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me on.
Next up, we've got Marko Bjegovic back, the founder and CEO of Arcomino Research, where he provides in-depth research on U.S. macroeconomics and markets as a whole. With over two decades of experience, Marko has in working as an equity broker, investment advisor, manager, even chief bank macroeconomist. Marco's forecasts and analysis help educate and inform investors the world abroad. Always happy to have you here, Marko. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Always a pleasure to have you as well. Next, we've got Adam Ozimek, the chief economist at Economic Innovation Group, serving on the executive team and leading an ever-growing font of research. He's also served as chief economist at Upwork and senior economist at Moody's, and his research has been cited pretty much everywhere from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times. Thanks for joining today, Adam. Always excited for your thoughts on these topics.
Thanks, Nicholas. Always glad to be here.
And we'll have one or two more speakers on the horizon. Brad Freeman, the stock market nerd, may be joining us along with economics professor Ben Galoob. But for now, I want to dive right in while we get those things hashed out. Now, in quarter one of 2025, the U.S. economy contracted by 0.3%, marking the first decline since, I think, early 2022. Now, my question on this is, did the surge in imports ahead of new tariffs contribute to this downturn? And what does it suggest about future economic momentum, especially amidst the fears and constant back and forth surrounding tariffs? Yuri, can you start us off here?
I think one of the things that has probably surprised people since Liberation Day was just kind of the extent of the tariffs and their sort of approach of implementing them in such a quick way, and then obviously giving this 90-day pause to tariffs, which itself I don't think actually resolves any of the issues and creates more uncertainty. And as we know, for the economy and businesses, the most important thing is really what Keynes back in the days used to call animal spirits, right? And in many ways, what is happening is many companies aren't sure what the impact is going to be of these tariffs, where the tariffs are going to settle, what sort of trade deals there will be. And in an environment of uncertainty, most companies will press pause. And I think that's what we're seeing from a lot of what I would call soft survey data, whether it's surveys of CEOs, purchasing manager surveys, etc. Equally, we're also seeing pretty poor data from the consumer sector as well in terms of soft survey data. So again, consumer confidence is a multi-year low. A lot of consumers aren't prepared to make big discretionary decisions in the face of what they see as a bit of an uncertain environment. On top of the tariffs, there's of course also the government cuts coming through the Department of Government Efficiency. So short term, you've got like this kind of hit survey. I think the GDP numbers themselves can be a bit misleading because obviously, imports are kind of a negative onto GDP. And what was happening is a lot of, I mean, to a certain extent, there was some people front running tariffs, by bringing landed inventory into the United States. And there was some like this dislocation in the GDP data, for example, from gold imports and things like that. And this sort of makes sense, this kind of behavior, and we've seen a little bit of it. You can kind of see a bump from imports from places like China, et cetera. So where are we at with that environment? The hard data still continues to hold up okay. If you track credit card spending, all of this kind of stuff, it's probably just about okay, but it's possibly going to start to weaken based on the survey data. That's what history said. And that is how the market has reacted all year. I would say the fall before Liberation Day was kind of trying to foreshadow that. So a weaker economic environment is kind of what's happened. And I think it's transpired in part because the tariffs that were set by the Trump administration were maybe worse than the market thought, and certainly worse than some CEOs thought. Remember, a CEO of a business has to make decisions on a multi-year horizon. So this kind of uncertainty is not good for those kinds of decisions, because it's easier to just sit on your hands. And you're seeing that, right now we're in the middle of Q1 earnings season. Most of the companies you talk are just saying, there's uncertainty out there, the macro environment's difficult. Interestingly, most of the companies are able to quantify the impact of tariffs as they stand and are trying to give the market as much guidance as they can on this environment. I think that's what's happening. So short term, there's absolutely a lot of economic uncertainty, and the GDP numbers may be a kind of reflection of that. Survey data is a better reflection of that. If you look a little bit more medium term, what a lot of the companies are saying equally with their earnings releases is, well, we need to be investing more in the US. And we've seen actually reshoring announcements by companies balloon since the start of the year. We've started to run a database. We're counting 33 major announcements from companies as different as kind of Novartis, ABB, Saint-Gobain, all of these different kinds of businesses. And they're making announcements about investing in the US. And part of this is to beat tariffs. Part of it, of course, is also PR and fluff, and companies are trying to put together business plans that they already had and calling it big announcements of investment to try to placate the administration. But we see this on the ground. The reality is there are plans going down, and that, if you think about it, is the only real solution long term for the current situation, at least under the current administration for the next 4 years. So that will itself bring some economic activity, but it's in the medium term because it takes time to put these plants down and build plants, and we'll see how that sort of plays out. So I think the environment right now, to paint a picture for this panel, is one of short-term economic uncertainty, survey data, still unclear how that's going to hit hard data, and this kind of medium-term build-out of more manufacturing in the United States. And so it's an interesting balance for the stock market to try to understand.
Thank you so much, Yuri. A ton to unpack there and a lot that I'm going to come back to, but kind of continuing in this same vein here, alongside GDP, we've seen a pretty dramatic slowdown in consumer spending this first 2025 quarter as well, following an end-of-year spike in 2024 that seemed to be pretty positive. But here in 2025, Q1 increased only by 1.8% compared to 2% in the same time in 2024 and 2.5% 2 years ago in 2023, marking that gradual slowdown of consumer spending over the last 3 years. So in the context of everything we have going on macroeconomically and global economics, what factors are really influencing this deceleration? How might it affect growth in the coming quarters? And is this deceleration itself as concerning as some economists have made it out to be? Brad, love having you back after so damn long, man. What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that, thanks for having me. So the 1.8% consumption growth annualized was actually a lot better than expected. I think consensus was around 1.2%. And also important to point out that, although it remains to be seen what kind of impact tariffs are going to have on inflation rates, the year-over-year comp is comping versus faster inflation versus lower inflation. So that impacts nominal comp for sure. So to me, that consumer piece of Q1 GDP was actually kind of heartening. And then you saw that you're hearing companies like Caesars say they're not seeing any impacts to booking trends. Booking.com said something very similarly. PayPal is talking about, we're really not seeing any consumer softening in our very globally oriented business, but at the same time, they're all baking in They're all kind of holding their breath and baking in a margin for safety in case that does come. I think PayPal has had like 2 or 3 points of e-commerce deterioration for growth. But I mean, even the Metas of the world and the Googles of the world with extreme exposure to Chinese sellers, I think 10% for Meta and 15% for Meta and 10% for Google, they are all seemingly finding buyers elsewhere for their impressions, which is another positive read through for the consumer. So, I mean, Meta, we all saw the news about Temu and Shein cutting ad spend down to zero, Meta was especially vulnerable to. But they're guiding the 13% year-over-year growth next quarter, despite that large APAC headwind. So that is, I understand that that's not a direct read through to the consumer, but it's a very tight indirect read through to the consumer because no one's buying these impressions if ad conversion rates are falling and no one's buying the products or services that are being sold or trying to be sold as part of these impressions. So I think consumer slowing is definitely obvious at this point, and you rightfully pointed that out. But I think it's slowing, understandably, based on everything I just said, and also, I think Yuri, nice to meet you. My name's Brad. But he talks a lot about survey level data and I mean UMish sentiment data and UMish inflation expectation data and I mean I'm an alum of that university, so go blue. I love that school. But a lot of these polls and a lot of these survey level data that we've seen is highly polarizing from a left wing right wing perspective. I'm not going to pick sides because that's not my place. But there's a large dichotomy between expectations for left wing pundits and right wing pundits, and I think that's important to point out. But other consumer bellwethers, Bank of America saying spending is resilient, and we're looking for it, but we're just not seeing it. So I know you have the JP Morgans of the world and Jamie Dimons of the world saying recession is a base case. But when you look around these consumer-facing brands across the board, the theme of earnings season so far is, yeah, we're expecting it, and we're geared up for it, and we're holding our breaths, and we have it baked into guidance, but we're just not really seeing it yet. And I think that bodes well for the unicorn that is the American consumer. It doesn't really make sense how resilient the U.S. consumer has been over the last several years, over the last several cycles. But here we are, and here it continues to be. And we'll see what kind of impact tariffs have, and we'll see how that policy evolves. But right now, it's all expectations, it's all nervousness, it's all anxiety. It's not structural decay to a point where these companies can't find profitable growth and can't find the types of results that investors want. But it's definitely a tougher environment. I think it's just not an extremely tough environment, and I think some of the noise out there would make you think that things are worse than they currently are right now. And I think it remains to be seen if they actually get that bad.
Fair enough, Brad. So there are a few things I want to circle back to, but first I want to touch on that concept of projections versus current information. So one key point I want to hit here that might push back a little bit on the concept of it's just projections is that of supply chains, one of the main concerns that economists have voiced amidst the tariff uncertainty. And indeed, we are already seeing signs of this. Now, granted, this first one is a projection of the upcoming, even week from now, of as high as 35% of shipments to the West Coast to drop off. But one that has already occurred and is showing signs of accelerating is that of container bookings from China to the U.S., which have already fallen nearly 45% year over year. So I'm curious, what does this metric say about the situation, especially if we see these shipments fall even further? Adam, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you're right. That is the number one piece of real data, hard data, you might say, that has moved. So far, mostly what we have is people are getting nervous. I would say another piece of evidence also is you have a lot of publicly traded companies either lowering their guidance or removing their guidance entirely because they are nervous about what's happening. So I disagree with Brad that this is just about some polarized pundits for two reasons. One, the University of Michigan survey isn't a survey of pundits, it's a survey of consumers. So at most you're talking about polarized consumers. But if people believe that inflation is going to be high, and enough of them believe it, then that in itself can become a hard economic fact in the sense of affecting behavior. And so I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss that, well, Democrats are more negative about inflation expectations than Republicans are. For the most part, consumers haven't paid a dollar of tariffs yet. A little bit, they've started, but like the fact that inflation expectations moved up before people even started paying for tariffs, I think is a sign that people see this coming. And I think you're going to see a little bit less polarization once it starts to hit people's pocketbooks. But yeah, the decline in shipments out of China, I think, is the tip of the spear. That's the first thing that's going to happen. And then, you know, companies will they'll work down their inventories that they built up in Q1. We saw that in the GDP data, a huge buildup of inventory. So they're building up a buffer. And then it's an open question of when this starts to hit prices. And frankly, whether the administration keeps things in place long enough to hit prices. There's a little bit of a Mott and Bailey here where folks like to say, look, I mean, the markets have recovered a lot. And, you know, clearly there's nothing. Everyone was you know, worrying too much about the tariffs. You know, everything's going to be just fine. But what's changed is that the administration keeps walking them back. So the two very different stories. One is the trade war that they launched. Everyone was worried too much about it. And they've been proven to be, you know, excessive worriers as time has gone on. And it seems like we'll be able to adapt. That's one story. That's not true. The real story is that the administration facing a market panic, facing surging yields on interest rates, has drastically walked back what was a terrible plan. And the question is whether they are walking back the plan far enough to prevent a recession, whether they will walk the plan back further. Now, remember, all those country-specific tariffs that were set using the hilarious magical formula of the trade deficit, bilateral trade deficit, those were just on pause for 90 days. They didn't pull them down. So, you know, this is a very tough time to be forecasting, because if you would have said, you know, 30 days ago, I think we're going to hit an imminent disaster very quickly, you would have been right, contingent on the administration not reversing a huge amount of their policies. But that's what they did. And so I think that at least so far, from current, you know, policy standpoint, the worst case scenarios, probabilities are coming down. But I, in general, yes, I agree with the forecasters. Most of this is the folks here. Most of this is in soft data. Nicholas, you're right. The tip of the spear is the China shipments. Next, we'll see it at U.S. ports, and then we'll see it after inventories are down. We'll see it on U.S. shelves, and then we'll see it in prices, and then we'll see it in employment.
Thank you, Adam. Good points and counterpoints here. So I do, like I mentioned, want to tie back a bit to what Yuri mentioned about the economy's reaction so far. Former Trump economic advisor Stephen Moore has said before that, quote, I think the president's emphasis on tariffs right now is misguided because, as he said, we have a very wobbly economy. Now, on the other hand, plenty of pundits have said somewhat the opposite, that the economy itself has been quite strong despite the uncertainty. And so I'm curious, from the point of view of the panel, I'm going to kick this one around to the whole group. Which of these concepts and statements are more accurate? And how might tariffs, especially should that 90-day pause end and the formerly projected tariffs come to fruition on top of potentially even more, like the discussions with China have sort of hinted at, how might that further drive the sentiment? Let's start with Marco, and then I'd love to hear from Ben now that we've got him here as well.
Okay, so a lot of was discussed here. Actually, I'm just going to circle back to what some other people said here about the University of Michigan consumer sentiment and inflation expectations. Particularly, this type of survey actually is producing something like contradicting expectations. Because consumers are actually expecting to see the inflation going up, and at the same time they are expecting to lower their spending. So actually, if they are lowering their spending, then what is going to to keep this inflation, like what is going to fuel it. At first, of course, you have the tariff that is actually one-time price adjustment. But after that, what is actually going to, I mean, if you have a product that costs 100 and then you have a tariff, let's say that it's 20%, then the product costs 120% after tariffs. But what will happen after this 120? You will not get like 130, 140, and so on. You will just have consumers that are going to pay either for 120, and then they are going to be left with less disposable income to spend on other goods, which will actually mean in aggregate that the prices might not change that much. Like it's possible that inflation will not go up for longer than, I don't know, a month or two or something like that, like this. For as long as this transition period is actually in place. So actually, if we have only one time price adjustments, then I don't know how is inflation going to go up at 6% or whatever these inflation expectations are actually pointing to at this moment. So it's a bit contradictory. Like either you have a higher inflation or you actually have a lower spending. And then if you have lower spending, then it's a recession, and then inflation goes down. It will not go up. Like in all recessions, inflation actually goes up. There was one time during the 1970s that at first actually inflation went up, but after a year or so, it topped out, and then actually it started coming down. So actually, if we really get the economic slowdown, I don't think that we will get any type of an increase in inflation. And consumers, at least survey respondents, they seem to conflate inflation with prices. Like they think that if prices are going up, this means that inflation is going up, okay, for 1 month. But what after that? I mean, there needs to be something that is going to fuel this inflation for longer than 1 month for it to be sustainable. Otherwise, maybe, I don't know, we shouldn't really concentrate that much on the inflation part, and maybe we should concentrate more on whether the economy will actually go the other way. Maybe if consumer spending goes down, then we can have some issues here. But yeah, as someone has noted, so far in GDP, actually we didn't see that. Contribution of personal spending is actually more or less the same as in Q1 of 2024, which is around 1.2-1.3 percentage points. This is not like this is not something that is really imminently worrisome, but who knows? Maybe in Q2 the situation actually reverses, and that's actually quite possible if net exports are actually not going to be as much of a drag, like it is also likely. And maybe in Q2 actually we see something like personal consumption actually contributing less than indeed in Q1. If that happens, then we could potentially have a problem.
Fair points, Ben. I have a few things to follow up on that with, but what are your thoughts on what's been discussed so far? Thanks for joining.
Thank you. Sorry about my sorry about joining late. I'm delighted to be here. So on Marco's just thoughts just now, I mean, I think there are a bunch of things really confused about the way you're thinking about this. One is that, you know, inflation is not the kind of Econ 101 model that you have in mind. Prices go up and that's it. It's a step function. That's just not the way macroeconomic models of inflation work at all. Prices go up. People don't know why they're going up. Sometimes they go up because inflation is happening. Sometimes they go up because of specific shocks like tariffs. And, you know, things ripple through the economy. Price, there's two things that could happen, a recession or inflation, but both of them can really happen because inflation happens through a sequence of responses by private actors and government where, you know, and let's just focus on the private actors. People raise their input costs, go up, they raise their prices. That means other firms are facing increased prices. They increase their prices. And if you have a simple theory that process is going to like stop in some simple, predictable way, you should go win a Nobel Prize because no good economist has such a theory. And you're just, you know, we can draw a little Econ 101 diagram where it's just a change in relative prices. But that's not how it happened during COVID, right? And during COVID, we had what many macroeconomists, including like Jason Furman, said, well, you know, like he wrote great threads saying this is not a fundamentally inflationary shock. Maybe we're becoming supply constrained for a while in some goods, but spending should shift. You know, these are relative price shifts. That is the Econ 101 view. And it proved really wrong for analyzing what COVID did to the macroeconomy. And of course, when we thought about further, you know, now here we're having an interesting thing where U.S. equities stand to be really badly hit by the aggregate shock to basically a lot of different investment and production processes. And so we have a situation where the central bank is going to be under a lot of pressure not to be more dovish and then, you know, including political pressure. So it's just kind of crazy. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's crazy to me to sit here and think with this scale of senseless shock, we're just going to like apply some Econ 101 model in a statically and say, oh, it's all going to be simple and it's all just going to be some relative price changes. And of course, by the way, the consumers in the survey are wrong. They don't understand a lot of things. But I think the main thing is that, you know, people are expecting this to be bad. And it's true that they're not going to be especially articulate or consistent about how bad. But I just want to take issue with the simplistic modeling in that answer.
Fair enough. So I want to kind of dive this vein a little bit further. But first, I kind of want to touch on some of the company reactions to the tariff situation that are being potentially a little forward looking in terms of what might happen with the projected trade deals, if any. So in response to this current tariff situation, companies such as pharma giant Eli Lilly has their $27 billion plan to build, I think it was 4 new manufacturing sites in the U.S. And other companies, indeed, like automotive companies, Ford is very proud of its, I think, 80% product built here in the U.S., which I want to be clear, doesn't necessarily mean the materials for those products come from the U.S. But there's been some talk that automotive companies specifically might be exempt from some tariffs should they maintain an 80 to 85% of product made in the U.S. But I'm curious, what other examples are there aside from these larger companies that are kind of focusing in on this reshoring concept, trying to kind of get ahead of some of those potential future effects tariffs might bring? Yuri, what kind of things are RSHO looking at from your perspective of how companies are trying to get ahead of what might be coming?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the discussion is really interesting because we've now had earnings season, which has obviously come after Liberation Day announcement, although the earnings are reporting on Q1, and Q1 is probably a lot stronger than people thought. It's a little backward looking in a way, because especially if you had pre-buying and things like that. But if we just focus on what companies are trying to do, right? You know, these are multinational, many, many sort of complex layer businesses that are trying to deal with quite an uncertain situation for themselves. And what we're hearing from a lot of businesses is that there's simply only one answer to this. So if you think back to the Biden administration and the major acts and the kind of industrial policy that was pushed through the CHIPS Act or the IIJA or the IRA, et cetera, I think in many ways, activity of building manufacturing in the US was sort of optional. And it was subsidized. So it was kind of the carrot. under the Trump administration, I think building plants in the US is a sort of strategic prerogative. Like, you have to do it because there's a stick there if you don't. And what we're seeing is, yes, companies will of course play the PR game in the face of this, but many of them are actually making large announcements, and we speak to the companies that will be building some of these plants, and they're actually seeing activity pick up in these areas. And it's across all different kinds of sectors. You mentioned Eli Lilly. Pharma has actually been one of the major factors, I think, partly because the tariffs on pharma have maybe not been announced, so they're trying to get ahead of it much more. But we had big announcements from Johnson & Johnson, Novartis, Eli Lilly, about investing large amounts of money in the billions into the United States. But it's drinks companies Diageo, it's Mitsubishi Electric, it's Hyundai, it's IBM, it's a lot of businesses across different sectors. And even if you sort of round down, since the start of the year, we count something close to $2 trillion worth of announcements. Now, of course, some of those are going to be over multiple years, but this is a large amount of investment that has been sort of committed towards the US. This is reshoring, and it's a multi-decade trend to do this. Now, we can argue, and we have argued, whether this is going to be, how this capacity is going to be built. Is this capacity going to bring jobs, or is it going to be mostly automated? Because modern plants will have to be in order to be cost efficient. But this is a large amount of investment going into the US and kind of confirms what has already been building under the surface, which is the incremental capacity of many multinational companies right now, if they want to serve the US market, has to go into the US. And this is what we're seeing at kind of point one. Most companies on earnings calls and our press releases outside are making these announcements. And the ones that aren't making these announcements are basically eyeing expansion. So there's a huge list that Reuters put together and continues to maintain of companies talking about, thinking about moving that manufacturing. The second point is many companies are touting how much they've already invested in the US and how they have supply chains, supply bases that are spread out, and sure, some components will be purchased from abroad and will face tariffs, but the reality is they can shift production around. And this is important because there's obviously retaliatory tariffs coming from China and other places as well. And so the idea is that, can you try to move production around so that it avoids or minimizes the impact of tariffs? The other thing that we're hearing from companies is they're raising prices. In fact, they were doing this before the tariffs came in, at their usual kind of January points. And these prices are being accepted by their customers. So companies are facing increasing costs themselves into imported components, and they're sort of raising prices on their customers. And that is a feature that we talked about inflation. You're seeing in some of the surveys as well. Certainly the prices paid by companies are going up, and that's being passed on. And eventually that will feed its way into consumer prices. And that's going to be a key question of how consumers react to that. And I kind of agree with one of the speakers was, it's probably going to be more demand destruction than sort of inflation sustained if we get into economic weakness. But the jury's still out on whether that will happen. And I agree that the data right now doesn't suggest that that is happening yet. And then companies are cutting costs, which is, of course, if for an individual business is great because you can maintain your margins. And many of the businesses that we own are doing that. But for the collective economy, it's not going to be good. Lots of job cuts. So in many ways, companies are kind of facing the tariff thing in three ways, but the one they're really focused on is trying to build more manufacturing capacity and investment in the US. That's really where they're driving medium term. Short term, they're raising prices, they're cutting costs, and they're trying to find ways of moving production around to mitigate the effect of tariffs. And interestingly, going into earnings season, most of us would have thought that companies had a carte blanche to just cut guidance, and not cutting guidance, to remove guidance altogether. It's an uncertain environment. You can do that. But many companies, and I think this really speaks to how much supply chains have progressed, are able to give estimates. I mean, even a company like 3M, it's one of the most complicated businesses. They sell all kinds of things. We're able to put together within technically a month an estimate of what they think the impact of tariffs will be, and more importantly, put together a series of mitigations to those tariffs. So collectively, we're seeing businesses kind of say it's uncertain, the economic environment is unclear, this is what we're doing to maintain margins in our business, this is what we're doing to offset the tariffs, and this is what our production base looks like. And oh, by the way, on a 3 to 4 or 5 year view, we are investing in more capacity in the United States. So I think that's kind of the picture. I mean, take it as you will, but this is really the general kind of blueprint of the companies that we speak to. And by the way, importantly, this is all businesses. So whether they're listed abroad or in the United States, this is kind of the reaction to the current environment. And as some of the speakers say, we'll see how the environment progresses and whether these things are right. But there will be a hit to these companies' earnings. And I guess many of them are hoping that you get tax cuts and other things that will offset that. Hopefully that gives you a bit of a sense. And we've started to track these investments going in, and they will eventually show up in the data. And these announcements are vast, and they're very, very large. And most importantly, they've accelerated.
So I know you've got to get out of here, Yuri, but first, do you have time for one quick follow-up on that about challenges to reshoring?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a couple here. I think the main one
I wanted to touch on, actually, if you don't mind, is while reshoring does offer benefits like improved quality control and reduced transportation, there's the challenge of potential workforce shortages. And you kind of mentioned there at the end of your prior explanation that job loss is a potential concern. How are companies in reshoring manufacturing operations addressing that kind of challenge?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is one of the most pertinent ones, because what's happening is companies are trying to build more manufacturing capacity in the United States. But for that capacity to be competitive globally, once maybe tariffs are removed, or, companies aren't sort of stupid in many ways, right? They understand the political pressure, but they also understand that potentially in 4 years, things could look very different, and they'll be stuck with this manufacturing plant. And one of the solutions is, well, you've got to build capacity that is cost competitive. And the way you can do that in the United States is you build automated capacity. So you invest in automation. Now, other countries, especially in Asia, are well ahead of the US in terms of per capita use of robotics and automation. And this is where the US will have to be able to use ingenuity and rebuild that ability to build robotics and automation. This unfortunately means that for the agenda of the Trump administration, that the job growth, the manufacturing job growth associated with reshoring investment that's coming into the US might not be as large as people think if all of these plants are automated. I think there will be growth. It will just be in higher end jobs. And so some of the memes on the internet talking about, like, can't wait to get that iPhone assembly job. The reality is a lot of that is probably going to be done by machines if that investment is going to go into the United States. You know, Apple's made a $500 billion commitment to US over the next 5 years. Again, some of that will be fluff, but a lot of that will be plants built in Texas and other areas to not necessarily assemble iPhones, but probably build some of their servers and AI chips and more high-tech critical industries. And that, I think, is what the US is trying to really grab for. But yeah, it's a challenge because you don't have that labor base. As we know, 4 million or so manufacturing jobs have been lost over the last 40, 50 years in the US. And rebuilding that, the next, 1 million manufacturing jobs to build that reshoring boom are going to be very, very different in their nature. And I think that's an important thing to capture in understanding. And many of the investments we're making in our reshoring fund are focused on automation as a way of enabling reshoring investment in the United States.
Well said, Yuri. And as always, thank you guys at Tame ATFs for sponsoring these conversations. Just beautiful things I learned from all of them. I know you got to get out of here. So if there's anything you want to add before I start kicking some ideas around with the rest of the panel here for a bit, please do. Where can people learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for hosting us. And apologies, I have to jump. I'll leave the other panels to discuss some of the macro implications as well. I think the key thing is, you can sort of learn more about, we track the reshoring space very carefully. I think it's evolving. It's certainly much more on people's radars than it was 2-3 years ago when we launched the fund. You can head to our website, www.tamaetfs.com. It's got loads of information about both the reshoring fund and lots of articles that we've written about the theme. We've linked one here that I just recently, or our fund manager, Chris Semnick, recently penned about powering Made in America, which is sort of talking about how Made in America could become a reality and equally the importance of electrification as part of that. It's an area that we think is really, really important because a lot of, as you say, the automation and investment that's going into the US requires a lot of electricity, and the electricity grid in the US is in a terrible shape and needs a lot more investment. And that's an interesting sub theme of reshoring and a theme in its own right as well. So people can head to www.tamaetfs.com and find out as much information as you like, subscribe to the newsletter. I'm always happy to think about all of those things going forward.
And the article he's referring to, folks, is already nested at the top of the panel here. So definitely check that out. Thanks as always, Yuri.
Thank you so much.
All right, Adam, I see your hand there. Thanks for being patient. I know you've got some follow-up thoughts. Hit me with them, man.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that the idea that we can take self-reported onshoring plans at face value is a little bit naive. Yuri himself pointed out that there's PR involved in companies when they're talking about tariffs, but for some reason he only implied that that was true when they were talking about the problems of tariffs. The reality is that we know for certain many of these companies were planning on doing these investments anyway. Apple's $500 billion investment, that was coming anyway. That was happening anyway. That's just their normal R&D in the US for this year. It's just on track with the recent trends. We've seen this before where companies will lie and pretend that they're doing things because of the tariffs. And this is because tariffs breed corruption, because it's just all it takes is just the president's pen to give companies exceptions to these tariffs. And so what happens is a company like Apple says, oh, we're spending $500 billion in the U.S. for doing this onshoring initiative. And, you know, they let the president brag about that. They let the president take credit for it. And then, as we've seen, the president gives them exemptions for their iPhone parts, for their iPhones, whatever it is that they're importing. They get these special exemptions. It's extremely naive to take these reports at face value and not consider the political economy of them. In fact, we know that manufacturing construction spending skyrocketed towards the end of the Biden administration as a result of IRA and, you know, pressures from COVID to what people learned about their supply chains to offshore. Construction spending on manufacturing is already high. So it's a very ripe time for companies to be like, oh, look, I'm planning on building this facility. Yes, they were going to do that anyway. That was already happening anyway. And I think a pretty good data point for this is to look at Yuri's ETF. You know, this is their onshoring ETF meant to track the progress of onshoring the U.S. economy. What happened to it after Liberation Day? It plummeted 10%. Okay, so if these tariffs were good for onshoring, then why is the onshoring index seem to fall when tariffs go up? And then as Trump walks back his plan for tariffs, the onshoring index recovers. And so if this index is capturing onshoring activity, or companies that are benefiting from onshoring activity, it's sending a very strong signal that the tariffs are not good for onshoring. So I think you have to be very skeptical of what companies are telling you. And you cannot be asymmetric on this issue. There are many companies that are cutting back plans, cutting back planned investment. And, you know, look at this issue symmetrically, look at the data, take the public choice problems into consideration. There's no sign that this is accelerating onshoring, and there's no reason to suspect it would be accelerating onshoring. Many of the most globally competitive companies, especially exporters, are embedded in what you call global value chains. They import goods from all over the world, and they use those goods to make things in the US, and then they export them, or they use them for local demand. The ability that what tariffs do is restrict a company's ability to embed in a global value chain to source materials from all over the world, from the best companies all over the world. If you're trying to make a globally competitive good, it's a terrible time to try to locate in the US. The tariffs make it extremely hard to be globally competitive because there's tons of uncertainty about where this is going to end up. And you may be paying taxes on the goods that you're importing, making it nearly impossible for you to be globally competitive. So for all those reasons, I think it's important to really strongly reject this idea that tariffs are some good thing for onshoring. We may see more onshoring, but it's onshoring that was coming anyway as a result of supply chain shocks. It's onshoring that's happening despite the tariffs, if anything.
Some fair points, Adam. Thank you. I always love getting the full multifaceted take on pretty much all these topics. So I want to kick this over to Ben, because I'm sure you have some responses to the last few topics here, Ben.
Yeah, just really quickly, I related to what Adam said. You know, there's also the margin of foreign suppliers, foreign firms like big Japanese car companies that announced they were exiting some plants. They were taking them out of the U.S. because for them, of course, the tariffs have an effect. And so whenever we think of onshoring happening by U.S. companies, you have you know, you have to think about other firms that find it unbalanced. Now they're not going to be able to, you're basically facing companies with an ultimatum. Are you going to try to locate your entire high value production in the United States, or are you going to avoid the United States? And if you force that choice on a lot of companies, like just without having any, you know, preconception about what will happen, there will be effects probably in both directions. And it's about the net effect. And I think there's been, and I think that Adam's point about which way the ETF went, that's the market's best guess of the net effect, right? And so it's, you know, I think that's one thing we have to keep in mind as financial analysts when we are predicting the effect. There's this, there are definitely, even aside from the bullshit onshoring that Adam kind of criticized that shouldn't be taken at face value, there is probably some real movement on the margin, but there's all this other counter movement, and there's the effects, which my academic work is all about, which is that just generally when these value chains get more frictional, more unpredictable, more subject to constant uncertainty, disruption, which is like poison for investment in these kinds of global value chain formation markets, you know, that's just going to be a hit to all economic activity, even if we get a bigger share. So even if you thought we're going to get a bigger share of the smaller pie, which I don't even think is right, the shrinking of the pie is being assessed by the financial markets is pretty substantial. And so I feel like that's kind of a good taxonomy to think about it. And I feel like this conversation is really surfacing a lot of the forces that have to be in that tally.
Thank you, Ben. So something I kind of want to close us out with is a bit of a broader topic, and I kind of want to get all of our remaining panelists' takes on this one. So we touched a little bit on retaliatory tariffs earlier in the panel, specifically Canada's, Mexico, which has introduced tariffs on agricultural exports from the U.S. as well as industrial goods. What are the potential implications of these measures for U.S. exporters and the agricultural sector specifically, especially given there's, you know, potentially some relief on the horizon? Trump's administration saying there are several opportunities in countries reaching out for trade deals to be struck to hinder the effects of tariffs on the global economy. And some news sources have said the U.S. has utilized multiple channels to reach out to China to negotiate tariffs, but the White House denies this. There's just so much confusion. But I'm wondering, amidst all of this, from the foreign perspective outside of the United States, the international community, what can really be done to rekindle confidence in America in terms of international trust, in terms of international trade? What sort of deals may be struck to reinstill this confidence, though many have said the damage is done and there might not be anything? What would it take here? Let's go, Marco, and kick her around.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to say what actually could be done here, but as with everything, it's probably about negotiations. It's crucial that all of these countries are actually talking, and that they don't just unilaterally make some decisions. Like we've seen a lot of things going on between the U.S. and China. President Trump comes and he says, "Yes, I'm talking to Xi," and then China says, "No, we are not talking to the U.S. at all." And it's like all of that is creating a lot of confusion. Whether they are actually talking or not, we don't know. we can only guess, but probably they actually need to talk because there is no other way out of this situation without cooperation. Literally we need to see some negotiations taking place. We need to see some deals. Maybe if we start hearing some other countries doing deals, maybe at some point China says, okay, if other countries can do it, maybe we could do it as well. But I think it will be a slow process. I don't think this will happen like in weeks or months. It will probably take it will probably take longer, especially between the US and China, because their their views are really so much so far apart, and it's like it's tough to see how can any common ground be reached in any in any foreseeable future. For example, maybe with the UK and with the European Union and with Canada and Mexico, maybe here negotiations are going to be a bit easier than with China, but also there are other issues that need to be addressed here, including the VAT. President Trump has repeatedly said that he doesn't like the VATs that the UK and European countries are using, and the VAT is actually it's a significant source of revenue in many countries, and it will probably take a lot of time before they actually get to, I mean, before they reach some agreement regarding VAT, because European countries are probably not going to say, okay, we are just going to abolish the VAT. And President Trump, maybe he softens his views, but that remains to be seen. Obviously, it's a painful process. It's a slow process, and it will take time before these things can actually be negotiated. As I said, the first step is always the hardest. The first deal that comes, maybe it instills confidence that other trade deals are possible, and we'll see what happens.
Thank you, Marco. Ben, could you close us out here? I'd love your thoughts. What is the international community's propensity toward kind of figuring things out as we move forward in time amidst the trade turmoil? Can the U.S. regain confidence in the international community with trade?
That's a really great question. I think one really powerful lesson, one case I've studied and have learned a lot from a great team of economists, was what happened after during the Russian oil and gas, the Russian gas crisis, mostly with respect to Germany. And there's this very important principle that economies are a lot more adaptable than individual firms or individual industries. So people were taking the structure of economic interactions in Europe at kind of face value and saying, well, like, and German executives were saying, you know, our economy is going to have a historic, unprecedented calamity, and we're going to have, you know, face the biggest crisis since World War II if we just cut off Russian gas. That's what, like, the senior executives at BASF and other firms like that were saying. And then Russia cut the gas pipeline anyway, and nothing, cut off the gas, and Germany adapted a lot of it by just buying gas intensive products from other countries. And so this is the kind of thing that, even though there was a huge hit to some aspects of German production that were the direct kind of, that were directly involved in the disrupted parts, the world economy, even the German economy, and certainly the world economy, managed to work around that just fine, because there's so many routes for goods to flow. And so I think in terms of the US, so there's this two separate questions. The overall economic impact, I think, will actually be globally a lot less. We're already seeing a huge shift away from US equities into European and Asian equities that are performing surprisingly well. So I kind of feel like the world is finding that the US doesn't have that strong a threat against it. That's how the economics feeds into the political economy, that, you know, perhaps in a different time, when the US really had its kind of a chokehold on certain important parts, there would be a sense that you kind of have to deal with the US and find a way. But as it stands, you know, I think the US is going to become a more normal country. There's definitely a deterioration to some extent of the world reserve currency status. And I think in terms of manufacturing, you know, one hopes that under different policies, we have policies that are more advantageous to the US, trade-off protectionism and efficiency as kind of usual, and hopefully do it in a way that kind of gets more economic value for the measures we impose. But I kind of do feel like the US, I feel like the US can restore participation in the economy that reforms. We'll probably get onto a different and somewhat worse path in the meantime, but I don't see any fundamental obstacles. We'll just have somewhat worse bargaining terms because the world will have found ways to work around us, as Europe did around Russia, which I think is a natural and great, you know, I think it's amazing that the world economy is, despite all the fragilities we love to talk about, on the whole, quite robust and capable of reshaping around disruptions. And so I view that as sort of good news for people in general, probably, you know, somewhat bad news for the US in the medium run.
Beautifully said. And I think that's a perfect place to wrap up. Ben and Marco, thank you guys for sticking it out with me to the end here. I know we had to go a little bit over time due to the technical difficulties, late start. Everybody, if you came in late, don't worry about it. This will be published later today on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Pod. I want to thank Tama ETFs and Yuri, as always, for sponsoring and participating in these. I really like getting all of these various perspectives on kind of what's going on. If you're not following the folks we've had here today, please do. I can't thank Ben, Marco, Brad, Adam, Yuri. I can't thank these guys enough. It's impossible for me to do my job without them, obviously, but I learned so much on these panels, as I'm sure even the panelists do. It's really nice to get these perspectives. Everybody, be on the lookout for future Unusual Whales panels. We also have an FOMC panel coming up this month. Thanks again, everybody, for your feedback today, and I hope you have a great rest of your afternoon. Take care, everybody.